Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of February. This hour, we're going to be talking about the U.S. military. Our guest has written a piece in the January 27 edition of the Wall Street Journal, Let's Have Flexible Armed Forces. He says the reality we face now is that both long war, and he'll explain more what long war is, and conventional capabilities are necessary, preparing only for what appears now to be the most likely conflict, the long war option, may very well make conventional war more likely in the future. Our guest is Dr. McCubbin Thomas Owens, Associate Dean of Academics for Electives and Directed Research, and a professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, also a senior fellow of the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia and editor of their quarterly journal. He specializes in the planning of U.S. strategy and forces, naval and power projection forces, the political economy of national security, and American civil-military relations. He's a contributing editor to National Review Online and a regular contributor to the New York Post, and is currently working on a book titled Sword of Republican Empire, A History of U.S. Civil-Military Relations. He is a Marine Corps veteran of Vietnam, wounded twice and awarded the Silver Star. And he served as Director of Legislative Affairs for the Nuclear Weapons Programs of the Department of Energy during the Reagan administration. We'll be welcoming phone calls. He likes to be called Mac, so we'll call him Mac, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number for you to call. Hello, Mac. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. How do you describe a flexible armed forces? What does that mean, Mac?
Well, there are a variety of threats throughout the world, and given the global responsibilities of the United States or the global role of the United States, we have to have the capability to do a number of different things. And in the past, we've faced a situation where people will say, well, this is either the most demanding or this is the most likely threat and plan only for that. And what happens frequently is you end up with a situation where you cannot respond to the other thing that happens, sometimes called the likelihood fallacy. If you prepare for the most likely or what you think is the most likely contingency, then an adaptive enemy will decide they're not going to confront you on that. They'll do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And you got clear, I think in my piece I mentioned what happened in the 1950s during the Eisenhower administration. The consensus was that nuclear weapons had revolutionized warfare. The choice was made by the Eisenhower administration. We would rely primarily on long-range strategic air power, nuclear air power, and that's where most of the defense budget went. And as a result, the Navy and the Army Marines basically suffered budget cuts, and our enemies during that time said, "Well, you know, we'll find a workaround." And so, that was the era in which you had the development of people's wars, revolutionary wars, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make sure, you know, I'm trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. So the likelihood that we are anticipating now, based on what we've already been dealing with, is what? That we're going to see more places like Afghanistan and more places like Iraq, or what?
Well, those sort of, not in the conventional sense. See, that was also a mistake I think we made in the 1990s, where we concluded that technology was going to solve all our problems. Again, the nature, as they said at the time, of war had been changed, and what we found was that, an adaptive enemy would negate our ability in one area and concentrate on those other areas that we had neglected, which was small wars, counterinsurgency, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've adapted, but I'm concerned. I think some people are concerned that the pendulum might swing too far back the other way, where we conclude that what we need is a force that can fight guerrillas, fight terrorists, do nation building, and the like. And what will happen over time is that our conventional capabilities will atrophy, and that would not be necessarily a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And by conventional, you mean what?
Well, what was traditionally seen as large-scale war, what we planned for during the Cold War, what we fought in the Second World War, what you saw in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and the first phase of this last war, where we focus our attention on the conventional forces of our adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that worked up to a point, but then again, an adaptive enemy is going to figure out a way to find a workaround, and that's exactly what happened in Iraq beginning in 2003 and until we changed our own approach.
Mm-hmm.
David Petraeus, the surge, but not necessarily just the increased number of troops, but also a change in our approach. The danger, again, is that we say, okay, that's going to define the future, and that's all we need to do, and I think that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the technology, the smart bombs that we are using, the targeted strikes in Pakistan, et cetera, that are happening right now. How effective has technology been in making warfare more precise, if that's the right word?
Well, I mean, it's been extraordinary. I mean, you have to say that I'm certainly no Luddite, and anybody who criticizes what happened in the 1990s is not somebody who's disregarding or denigrating technology. It's just to say that we need to be a little, have our understanding of war needs to be a little broader than that. But if you look at the accuracy of weapons these days, it's basically unprecedented. If you think in World War II, when we had aerial bombing in Germany, which at the time was considered to be precision bombing, with the Norden air, with the Norden bomb sight and so forth, you had what was called a circular error probable, a CEP, for a bomb was perhaps as much as a half mile, which basically meant that to actually hit the target you wanted to, you had to drop a lot of bombs, and those bombs were going to create a lot of collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
And now the CEPs of weapons are down to 3 meters, for God's sake, and you can literally, if you can identify the target, then you can hit it. Of course, the intelligence is the other side. You need to be able to do that. So I'm not saying we don't need the ability to make these kind of strikes. I just I think what you had in the 1990s was sort of this happy talk that suggested that that's all we needed, and that the traditional grunts in the mud weren't mm-hmm. going to be necessary anymore. And we found, of course, that's not true.
Right. You write in the piece last week that the ability of the U.S. to advance its global interests requires it maintain command of the global commons, sea, air, and space. The long war option is not sustainable without such control. That's a massive job, isn't it?
Well, sure, and that's part of the problem here. That as we see, the new president has at least the suggestion is coming around that the defense budget's going to be cut by about $55 billion. Now, admittedly, it's gone very high, but traditionally we've been able to justify that by saying that that's consonant with America's role in the world. Things are going to have to give. We're going to have to find better ways to do a lot of the things that we've done in the past, but it's very clear that probably the most important thing we need to do is to be able to, and the term global commons was coined by a friend of mine, Barry Posen at MIT, talking about the sea, but the ability basically to have the means to deliver forces wherever you need them. And if it's going to be done in a sustainable way, then we're talking about ground troops. We can, of course, deliver air power any place, but the effect of air power is not necessarily going to be long-lived.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the other questions that came just from what you said is that we also need to determine where we need troops, right?
Sure. And there was a long time, of course, after the Cold War, where we had troops forward-based because that's where the threat was. That was Europe and Japan. With the end of the Cold War, there's been a great deal of questioning whether we need all those troops in Europe. Now, their justification has changed from basically defending against a resurgent Russia, although, again, that's a long-term possibility, to providing something of a forward base so that we can move them to the areas we need them, for instance, the Middle East, wherever else we perceive a threat. But the problem, the dilemma is that it's like everything else. We want to do a lot of things. We think we need to do a lot of things, but there's only so much money to go around, and
right.
So we have to make some pretty serious choices.
Mm-hmm. And what about the money situation? Do you think that the military is being shortchanged?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, that again depends on what you say its mission is going to be. if there's going to be a pullback, then of course the military is not going to need the kind of money that it has had in the past. But there's no real indication that President Obama is going to change the broad outlines of American grand strategy. We're not going to become isolationists. We're not going to pull back in a lot of areas. I mean, as he's even said, you know, the drawdown of troops in Iraq, which he advocated during the campaign, well, where are they going to go? They're not going to come home. Many of them will go to Afghanistan. So short change depends on what you think the military needs to do. And if you're going to do it and you're going to do it seriously, you're not going to incur a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to provide the money. So at the present time, you know, we are. And there's always waste in the defense budget. But when you come right down to it, that constitutes a fairly small amount of what we spend. So it's a matter of what resources you have and what you need to do, and you want to reduce the mismatch between those two.
Right. And tell me, give me a much more detailed, I've just mentioned the long war, a much more detailed description of what the long war is, Mac.
That was a phrase that has come into vogue over the last couple of years. It's a replacement for the idea of the global war on terror, but it basically conveys the idea that in order to minimize the like of future terror strikes, radical Islamic terrorism and so forth, you need to be able to deal with not just killing the enemy, but basically doing the things that small wars have always required in the past. That is to pacify the populations, to convince them that you're on their side, and the like. And the kind of forces that are used for that sort of a situation are different than the ones that you'd have for the kind of conventional wars we've tended to prefer in the past. Again, as I said, I think we're going to have to be able to do both. But the long war basically simply means preparing primarily for small wars, terrorism, and the like, and less on large-scale state competitors such as Russia or China.
Mm-hmm. What are the hot spots right now? Would you agree with many analysts who say that Pakistan is the most dangerous country in the world?
Well, it has the potential to be. I think there's so many different things could happen. You've got, there clearly is a great deal of instability there. You have within the Pakistani government, you've got people who are jihadists, people who support the Taliban and support Al Qaeda and so forth, and you have others, I think, who see basically that could be very costly to Pakistan in the long run, and so they're pulling the other way. So there's a dangerous tension, I think, within the government that could spill over and create real problems for us, and not just for us, but for the region as a whole, for India and for the other countries in the South Asia.
Mm-hmm. So saying that our future warfare is likely to be hybrid in character, can you apply that to a country like Afghanistan, or is their military path pretty obvious right now? Could they surprise us with what they decide to do and we're not prepared for what they might do?
Well, you have to maintain as much flexibility as possible. I mean, that becomes a cliche. There's no question about it. The word hybrid, again, another friend of mine named Frank Hoffman is a retired Marine down in Quantico, and the Marines have been pushing this idea, which is to say that wars in the future are not going to be either or. It's not going to be strictly going to be guerrillas or strictly be high-tech and the like. That the kinds of threats we're going to face in the future are going to be a combination of the two. And oh, by the way, I mean, that's happened in the past. The model that most people point to when they think about hybrid war these days, at least the guys like Hoffman, is to say something like Hezbollah, which, you know, fight like guerrillas, but at the same time they have some high-tech capabilities.
Right.
I mean, I was in Vietnam. Vietnam, when you come right down to it, was a hybrid war. The place I fought, we fought only the North Vietnamese. Now, they fought in a way that, made it difficult for us to bring our strengths to bear. That was combined with the guerrilla war at different places and the like. There was the political aspect, there was the informational aspect, and so forth. That's all really hybrid means. It just simply means mm-hmm. that if you're planning to go out and take on the Soviet Red Army on the plains of Europe, and that's all you prepare for, then you're going to find yourself in a pickle. Mm-hmm. And if you prepare only to fight guerrillas someplace, you're going to find yourself in a similar pickle. You've got to be able to recognize that in the future, war is going to, as it has in the past, it's going to follow the path of least resistance. It's going to take on the shape that's going to be most valuable to the participants. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it'll be low intensity, sometimes it'll be higher intensity.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, Mac, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor McCubbin Thomas Owens, Associate Dean of Academics for Electives and Directed Research, and also Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. And he wrote a very interesting piece in the January 27 Wall Street Journal, Let's Have Flexible Armed Forces. To your calls in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Ray from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning to your guests. I'd like to comment on something you just said, as well as the comment I called in for. You said that maybe the most dangerous country is Afghanistan. Let me give you the reasons
Pakistan is what
Pakistan.
I said.
Let me give you the reasons why actually it's the U.S. is the most dangerous country in the world, and then I'd like to have my comment. We have already used nuclear weapons on populations in Japan, as we remember. We have enough nuclear weapons right now to kill the world three times over, and we spend twice as much as all the other countries in the world combined. We spend twice as much on military, so I think the world is looking at us as the most dangerous country in the world. But the reason I called in was, what does the guest have to say about a military and a defense department that in the last 8 years, Donald Rumsfeld made the first announcement on September 10th that he did not know what the Defense Department had done with $2.3 trillion. And since then, the Defense Department has admitted they have lost an additional $4.6 trillion. It's close to $7 trillion down a hole. Can you tell us what justification you have to ask for more money for these people who have lost that much in 8 years, and we are no safer today? Look what the banks are doing to us.
All right, Ray. Mac.
Well, I disagree with your premise on both counts. First of all, they haven't lost that money. You may not like the way it's been spent, but most of it's accounted for. We know going back that all large government agencies are not particularly good in handling these large sums, and the Department of Defense is not alone in that. But I disagree with the fact that your argument that we're less safe. You have to remember that this war, this attack on the United States in 9/11 was not the result of Bush policies. This was being planned during the Clinton years, which everybody these days kind of looks back and thinks of as the Golden Age. We were at war long before we knew it. We've responded to that. We've responded to it in different ways. There are debates within the Department of Defense where to spend these monies. But the fact that there has not been an attack on the United States since 9/11 indicates that we are more safe than we were in the past.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Let's talk about nuclear issues for just a moment here. I don't know if I can ask in terms of a level where you would put the level of a nuclear threat in the world right now, and also the role of nuclear in terms of the enormous amounts of money it takes to build facilities, other countries that are working toward building facilities, and to make it even a longer question, the number of loose nukes that might be floating around and available to people who would wish to do a lot of people harm, say in Russia and other parts of the world, and whether or not that's under control?
Well, the first part of the question is that you do have to have something of an infrastructure to build nuclear weapons. Now, having said that, the real danger that was justified some of the steps that the Bush folks took in the early in the first administration was the possibility that that a country that had developed a nuclear capability could then provide nuclear weapons to other non-state actors, and I have deniability, these sorts of things. The likelihood of a nuclear exchange involving the United States Senate, of course, is very, very low, I think. There are, however, possibilities, the possibility of an exchange between India and Pakistan, mm-hmm. I mean, the whole issue going on there. India and China, I mean, I think there are some possibilities which are considerably higher than zero. As to the whole issue of loose nukes, that's been one of the primary things we've been trying to do with regard to the Soviet Union after the former Soviet Union after it broke up, was to gain accountability of all these things. And again, I don't have access to the intelligence, but in general, I think that we've done a reasonably good job. In the long run, one of the problems is that this catch-all phrase, weapons of mass destruction, it's probably not the nuclear that perhaps provides the biggest threat in some of these areas. It's going to be chemical and biological. These are what one individual once called the poor man's nukes. You can develop chemical weapons which can have a tremendous effect, even catastrophic effect,
sure.
for far less money than you can to develop nuclear infrastructure.
And how do you fight that? What do you do about that?
Yeah, just good intelligence. You just have to be alert. I mean, that's the problem. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. I don't have access to it. And most people out there, we've got people working these problems all the time, and we know about it. We try to pursue leads. We try to keep the possibility as low as possible. But it's always out there. It would be much easier to launch some kind of a chemical attack or biological attack within the United States than it would be, I think, to smuggle a nuclear weapon in here. So I think that's the real more likely weapon of mass destruction we have to pay attention to.
Let's go to Frank from Madison next. Hi, Frank. Whoops, there we go. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Max is a fine guest. And I hope this isn't too obscure, but I would like to ask Max if the United States finds itself in a situation somewhat analogous to Britain at the turn into the 20th century, where she was faced with reconfiguring the Navy. And so there was a modernization that coincided with a withdrawal of global reach. And there was also the attempt to control the situation dealing with new rivals in Central and Far Eastern Asia, the Great Game. And so is the United States currently involved in a version of the Great Game, India, Pakistan, and confronting the new rise of China without an attempt to make it into a direct confrontation, as happened ultimately with Germany and Britain in the 20th century. So if that's at all relevant, I'll sign off and listen to your answer, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. It's relevant. Mac.
Yeah, thank you. That's an excellent question. As a matter of fact, I was in the introduction, I was going to raise that issue of the British Empire at the end of the 19th century when they faced the tradition had been that since the end of the Napoleonic Wars, their primary focus was on policing the empire, and that was what their army was built to do. It was built primarily to police imperial policing, colonial administration, and so forth. And in the latter part of the 19th century, you begin to see the rise of Germany, and one of the primary strategic requirements for the British was to prevent the rise of a single power on the Eurasian landmass, and that's what Germany was. But as late as when they had the defense committees and so forth meet at the end of the 19th century, the decision was made to continue the primary focus on the what was at that time be called, what we now call the small wars, that is, the imperial policing. As a result, when the war broke out in Europe, the British Expeditionary Force was really not prepared. It did okay, but the learning curve was pretty sharp because of the different kind of warfare. The British produced excellent battalions and regiments, but their ability to command and control and to coordinate arms at the higher level was far less evident. You see that with the huge losses that the British suffered at places like Passchendaele and Somme and the like. The Navy issue, of course, was part and parcel. They'd always been able to depend on the Navy as the first line of defense. And, when they basically had to recognize what was going on in Europe, they did, in fact, make a series of alliances to basically pull their Navy back from the Far East, and that probably had an effect later on when we get into the Second World War because of, the British fleet was smaller than it had been before. But I think that the caller's question ultimately is one of the examples I would look to in saying that to choose one direction, as the British did there, to make the commitment to the empire rather than what is later called the Continental Commitment, illustrated the high cost the British suffered in terms of casualties, indicated that they had to do both. Now, of course, they were limited by money, and they made a choice based on the resources they had.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good example, excellent example.
James from Galena is next. Hi, James.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking the phone call, and I'm interested in your guest. He seems to be very knowledgeable, probably has studied it much more in length than I have. But I have a little background in history. My two boys were in the military. Son-in-law is a master sergeant in the Marine Corps. My brother was in the military, and I happen to know a little bit about the appropriations that they go through. I worked for some companies that before I retired. These no-bid contracts, I mean, it's really ridiculous because, they just add on. And I know companies that have done that, just add on, and they know that they're going to get a cost plus on the contract at the end of the time. It's a built-in profit for them. That ought to be changed. And the appropriations that ought to be changed because the Marine Corps, my son-in-law was a controller for, I won't mention how many states or which section of the country he was over, but he was in the purchasing area, and for years and still going on today, they were instructed at the end of their calendar year to make sure that these different divisions spent all the money that was appropriated to them, because if they didn't, they wouldn't get the same amount of money next year or a little more next year, because if they didn't spend it all, the committees just wouldn't grant them their desire for the same amount of money next year. And this has got to be changed. I mean, we're going bankrupt in this country. It's not like the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, both of them are complaining about this stimulus package and the deficit. Well, in the last 8 years, we built $6 trillion onto our debt, and a majority of that come from this war. So we have to change.
Okay, Mac.
Well, listen, and this goes back to your first caller as well. I'm the last person who's going to defend the procurement system within the Department of Defense. It's a mess. We've been working on it. We teach courses up here at the Naval War College, as they do at all the war colleges, on how to deal with this. I mean, this is something that certainly didn't start with the Bush administration. It's not going to stop with the Obama administration. There are serious problems with how we basically procure equipment, how we issue contracts and the like. I'm no expert on that. I know enough about it. By the way, you forgot to mention that I actually used to work for the senator from Wisconsin,
Senator Kasten, yeah.
When he was on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee back in the early 80s. And we were aware of the problems then. I mean, the fact is just the way the money is first appropriated and then authorized by Congress, the way it's spent, companies are positioning themselves. I mean, these are terrible messes. And if anybody can come up with a way of getting a hand around this, I'm sure that they'd get a hearing at the Department of Defense, because this is a problem. Again, it's not nearly to the extent as your first caller indicated,
mm-hmm.
but there is really a problem. Now, by the way, it's not limited to the Department of Defense. I've spent enough time in looking at all government agencies to know that this is something that's associated with the large bureaucracies in the public sector. It's just you don't have the profit system in the market to give you the signals you need, and so you continue the way things are. And as mentioned, he's talking about companies, but it happens at the we're trying to prevent this. But I've been in situations too where the end of the fiscal year is coming up, you've got extra money. If you don't spend it, you have to give it back, and you won't get as much next year. Now, that's just plain nuts. That's
that is a little crazy. I want to move us into, we'll take more phone calls in a moment, another area now, because the current President Obama has talked about our taking resources from a war that needs to be fought in Afghanistan, and they're being drained because we've been in Iraq such a long period of time. A lot of people have wondered how many fronts can we handle at once in terms of our troop readiness, in terms of the number of troops we have, in terms of how much money we have for the military. Can we do both? And what if some third thing came along?
Well, there's your problem. You build a force structure, and you build it, you base it on a level of accepted risk. I mean, during the during most of the Cold War, we had a force structure that was based on what was called two-and-a-half wars. That was a war, a simultaneous war against the Soviet Union and China, with a half war someplace else, usually supposed to be in Latin America, something like a revolution like that. That was our force structure. Now, could we have actually done that? Well, Vietnam proves that we probably were even stretched. By the way, Vietnam became the half war, but I have to tell you, fighting in that war seemed like a whole war to me. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, right now, you go back to the Clinton years and into the Bush years, and you had what was called the two major theater war construct. That was, we would build forces that could simultaneously conduct two wars. Now, the reality was we would never have been able to do that. Now, force structure, the part of the force structure that's really under strain are the ground forces, the Marines and the Army. And they are stretched, although it's not nearly as bad as I think some people think. But it's very hard to do with the kind of rotations you need if you're going to basically give the people, you know, we've been fighting these wars, the time they need back in the States before they go back into combat. You know, I'm dealing with officers up here from all services, and most of them now, I'm going to talk about lieutenant colonels and commanders, most of them have been to Iraq and Afghanistan at least three times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
a lot.
It's a lot, and mm-hmm. It's going to have an impact on you in the long run. It is astounding, though, when you think about it, that you would think that everybody would be getting out of the service, but retention is high and recruiting is high. So, as you know, President Obama, during the campaign, called for an increase in the strength of the Army and the Marine Corps. But, of course, that costs money. Personnel costs are much higher than equipment costs. And so, you know, at the same time, we're saying, well, we're going to cut the defense budget. Now, well, how do you do that at the same time as you're asking for 40,000 more troops?
Right.
So, again, I mean, there's clearly is a limit to what we can do. It has to do with money. It has to do with the demographic base out there from which you recruit. It also takes time. You know, it's to take a soldier or a Marine, especially, and say, okay, you're recruited. You come in. You go through basic training. You go through your unit training. We don't want to just throw you in like cannon fodder, and you have to. That takes some time and training and the like. I will stipulate that ground forces are stretched pretty thin. Now, with the drawdown in Iraq, which I think is a result of improved situation there, I mean, this was what Bush had pulled for, and I think that ultimately it's been accepted by President Obama as well, is that we can begin to do this because the situation in Iraq is considerably better than it used to be. But you're right. There's always a problem. How many things can you do simultaneously? And how much risk are you willing to accept? And we're right at the kind of close to the limit on that.
Let's go to Daniel from Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. It is Russian military doctrine that if the U.S. military uses its superior guided munitions against Russian troops, Russia will resort to tactical nuclear weapons. In response, what would be the United States' retaliation? Tactical nuclear weapons? And wouldn't the danger still be full-scale nuclear war in a confrontation with Russia?
Well, you know, this represents something of a change. I know that for a long time the doctrine in the United States, that's why we developed guided munitions, the precision munitions in the first place, was to negate the necessity to use tactical nuclear weapons. Fact is, we've considerably reduced, almost eliminated, our tactical nuclear arsenal, and of course, both sides have drawn down their strategic. I think the likelihood of a conflict between the United States and Russia is very low. I think there are a variety of reasons for that. I think that the Russian military is still suffering the aftershocks of the last 20 years. I think that Russia benefited from an increase in gasoline in oil prices there for a while, they're now suffering the reverse as the prices drop. So I think the sort of military threat that the Russians pose directly to the United States is considerably low. Now, on the other hand, of course, as we saw with Georgia and with their implicit threats, sometimes not implicit, explicit threats against some of their neighbors, the likelihood that the Russians will use their military against what they call the near abroad is much higher than confrontation with the United States.
Thanks, Daniel, for the call. More calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking this hour with Professor McCubbin Thomas Owens. He's Associate Dean of Academics for Electives and Directed Research and Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval College in Newport, Rhode Island, contributing editor to National Review Online. He served as National Security Advisor to Senator Bob Casten, a Republican from Wisconsin, and also Director of Legislative Affairs for the Nuclear Weapons Program. And he also is a Marine Corps veteran of Vietnam, where as an infantry platoon commander in 68 to 69, he was wounded twice and awarded the Silver Star Medal, retired from the Marine Corps Reserve as a colonel in 1994. So the article we're talking about, if you want to read that as well, is in the January 27 edition of the Wall Street Journal, Let's Have Flexible Armed Forces. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls. Mike from Sussex is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I'm Kathleen. The question I have is in relation to the guest's comment in response to the first caller, who I agree was a little hyperbolic in his statement. You made a comment that we haven't had any attacks since 9/11, so that is an evidence of the fact that we are safer now as a result of the actions that we've taken. And I've heard that statement made by both military personnel as well as politicians, specifically from the Republican Party under George Bush. But there's so much that as a public we don't know and we probably shouldn't know. But you've demonstrated a lot of candor in your comments, so I feel confident that I get some kind of an answer out of you. I mean, that's not necessarily the case, that just because we spent a bunch of time and money addressing some what would be security issues, that when we haven't had any attacks, that we are safer, because we weren't attacked prior to 9/11 either, and we hadn't done any of those things. So, I mean, it's the lack of attacks doesn't necessarily mean that we are safer. It may mean that our enemy is biding his time, waiting for a better opportunity, a better application of his resources.
Hmm. Mac?
Well, I mean, I don't know how to respond to that except to say that I don't know what other things we can say. Of course, there are a variety of... It's hard to conduct experiments in the social sciences because you can't hold variables constant the way you'd like to. But as I said before, yeah, there weren't attacks directly in the United States. Well, if you go back to 1993, and you had the first attack on the Twin Towers, which was bots, but it still caused some casualties. You had the other attacks on the American embassies. You had the attacks on the coal. You had a number of things happening. So there was a lot of this was going on. And again, it was our failure to say, well, you know, listen, we're under attack here, and we should be responding in a particular way. The fact was that the attack did come. It could just as well come during the Clinton administration, but the timing was right when they attacked 9/11. So, you know, I cannot say for sure that the only reason there has not been an attack is because we've been preparing for it, but I don't see any other way to think about it. If you can come up with another idea, that's fine. And it may very well be, I mean, that's always a possibility that our adversaries are waiting and biding their time and so forth. But here's another thing, that when they were had a base in Afghanistan, it's much easier for them to plan these sorts of things than it is when they're on the run. There's been a lot of sociological research into sort of the terror networks and so forth, and it turns out that you know, there is a certain security when you have a sanctuary, as Al Qaeda did back at the when they launched their 9/11. If you take that sanctuary away, if they're constantly running, guerrillas, terrorists break up into smaller groups. They have to do this for security, but when they're taking care of their own security, it's much harder for them to plan these sorts of things. It's not out of the realm of possibility. But again, this is based on their little astounding amount of sociological research into these terrorist networks, and that's one of the indications there. So I'm thinking that it's, you know, we keep pressure on these guys, wherever they are, working with allies, working with friends, using our intelligence assets, direct action when it's necessary, that if they're running for their lives, they're not thinking about how to launch another attack against the United States or anybody else.
Do you think that we, and I don't know if we have where this information would even come from, Matt, but do you think that we've done a fairly good job in maybe unraveling a lot of these networks?
I think so. I mean, again, I'm not privy to the intelligence, but remember one of the things that President Bush said right after 9/11, he said, this war is going to be a long one. And there will be some things we will know about, but there will be lots of things we don't know about. And I think the things we don't know about, based on, again, my discussions with people who can say only so much, is that, yeah, we've had some success in unraveling, pushing, breaking up these organizations and making their life much more difficult than it would be if they had a nice sanctuary where they could sit around and plan their attacks as they did in 9/11.
Right. Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. Let's go to Wayne from Holman next. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, guest. I salute you, sir.
Thank you.
And I thank you for your service to America and what you're continuing to do. And I think you're right to a large extent. I think George Bush, even though I don't agree with a lot of things he's done, has implemented some programs that have definitely kept this country safe and maybe even prevented further terrorist attacks on us that we don't even know about. But my question to you, Max, is I served in the Northern I Corps of South Vietnam, and I don't know if you ever heard of a little bird called Qua Viet.
Yes, I do.
You did? Okay, I was on a Riverine unit.
Yeah.
And I have a special place in my heart for Marines because we had a Marine on board who manned our Starlight scope.
Yeah.
And I know you're familiar with that technology, but it replaced the infrared.
Sure, sure.
And he was an African-American guy. And, of course, in those days, I was there 67 through half of 68. They kept me because I was pretty good on the 81 mic. But he was a great guy. Sadly, he didn't make it home. We were in a free fire zone, and it got really nasty. But anyway, the Marines have always had a special place in my heart. He was unbelievable with that Starlight. He could pick Charlie out 1,000 yards away, and it was just he was just a neat guy. And of course, as you well know, sir, when you're there, color means nothing. And we were all brothers in arms, and I look at you that way. So I just wanted to say thank you. And I left with a piece of shrapnel on my back, and I carry it to this day. And it's just one of the memories that I don't talk about it much, but I just wanted to relay that to you. And I know you were awarded the Silver Star, and so your bravery it says it all right there. But thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for yours. I mean, I don't like to whine, but, you know, the Vietnam veterans had probably a tougher time than others folks coming back, not in terms of their actual performance, but what people thought about them. You know, Vietnam veterans have done just as well as any other veterans group in the history of the United States, and I thank you for your service. And yes, I'm very familiar with the Quaviet River, that whole area, Northern I Corps. So, you know, thank you to you and all the other listeners who served the country. So I certainly appreciate it.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Chris from Glendale. Hi, Chris.
You know, of course, about NEST, the Nuclear Emergency Search Team, that is a group that would attempt to find a nuclear weapon in the United States, smuggled in, and defuse it before it blows up. I have never understood what scenarios they would face once they locate a smuggled nuclear weapon. Do they attempt to zap it with electronics? Do they attempt to blow it up asymmetrically using dynamite? I've read a bit about this, but there just isn't that much in print.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know the details. When I worked in the legislative affairs of the nuclear weapons program at the Department of Energy, NEST was one of the things. We had an interesting war game one time, which was a scenario that was developed. It was supposed to be a terrorist seizure of a warhead being moved. Now, the truck was equipped with all sorts of defensive measures. It was very interesting because when the terrorists first took, you know, in this scenario and so forth, and they held the truck, and immediately they initiated the first thing, which was to fill the whole area with this foam, which made it impossible for the alleged terrorists to get it off the truck. So we had to stop the operation and let them take it off the truck so we could continue with the test and the operation. The smuggling is a different matter. Again, and I don't know the details of this. There are probably technical ways they do it. My guess is that you're going to focus primarily on the people who have taken it, not the weapon itself, to try to neutralize them to make sure that it's not detonated in an area that's going to cause problems. But you know, this is way above my clearance right now, so I can't really talk about it in any kind of detail. Even if I knew it, I wouldn't. So, but I don't know it.
Right. It's the kind of thing that can keep you up at night thinking about something like that, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks, Chris, for the call. Jan from Delafield is next. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Our oldest son didn't listen to his Vietnam vet father and joined the active duty Air Force and is currently on his third tour in Iraq. Mm. And has had a number of comments about equipment and personnel. He notes, for example, the F-16 has had a very poor record because it doesn't do well, apparently, in the sand, and says that most of the things it does can be fulfilled by non-pilot aircraft, UAVs, and that many of its precision ground attack roles can be done safely and a lot more cheaper by Army artillery. But and while the Air Force doesn't want to give up manned fighters, they are quickly realizing that they pretty much have to go to these unmanned vehicles while they're there. One of the primary roles that crew-flown vehicles serve is transport, but they're also being used for communications and surveillance over the top of the cities, another role that's being fulfilled increasingly by unmanned aerial vehicles. The problem with having to go over there as often as he has is pretty obvious, I think, for married men and women who have to leave families behind for a substantial time. The Air Force, like the Army, is seeing a lot of family problems. But he's single, and he has spent so much time overseas in the last few years that he's wondering where he's going to find time to pitch woo to a woman.
Oh, Mac, what about that?
My sympathy goes out to him. I mean, that is certainly an issue. Well, again, I go back and I stipulate that the rotation rates are extraordinarily high, not just for the ground forces, but also for the Air Force and the Navy as well, although in a different capacity. As regard the UAV versus the manned aircraft, that's an interesting debate that's going on within the Department of Defense and within the Air Force. And the Air Force, of course, has built its culture around manned aircraft. But they're increasingly coming to the view that there certainly is an increased role for UAVs. The fact is they can do a lot of the things, just as the caller said. They can do a lot of the things that manned aircraft have done. There are things that manned aircraft can do that that UAVs can't. But the question is, like everything else, you have to figure out what the balance is going to be between them. In the case of the F-16, it's not only that it's the operating environment, but it's the fact that it's an old airplane. And old airplanes, the maintenance problem begin to basically creep up, and so your flying hours sometimes tend to go down. But my best wishes for the Air Force son. He just find himself a good woman.
Yeah, and for the forthcoming romance, wherever it should take place. Mac, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Our guest this hour, Professor McCubbin Thomas Owens. He's from the U.S. Naval War College, and we thank Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9:00.